In addition to the cancer's unique histology, are there any other targets being used to guide treatments? For example, what's the role of biomarkers?
Biomarkers really have integrated themselves even into first-line therapy at this time, and I think this is particularly of interest in the adenocarcinoma population. That's the population of patients that we typically interrogate for certain things that have therapeutic implication. Biomarkers can be prognostic. They can tell you whether a patient's going to do well or not well. Biomarkers can also be predictive in the sense that they can identify a patient that's either going to get a great benefit from a certain therapy or get no benefit from that particular therapy. And I think in non-small cell lung cancer, particularly in the adenocarcinoma population, I think the standard of care is in selected patients to, again, interrogate their tumor for the presence of an EGFR mutation, because I think that's the one population, if they do have a sensitizing mutation, that we can deviate from our decade-old standard of platinum-based therapy, as we've been discussing here. And I think this is the way the field is going. I think we're going to be looking for more biomarkers, and I think it's important to recognize that that should be part of your evaluation of patients in a selected manner.
So this is not an inconsequential problem, though. We know that lung cancer affects a huge number of Americans. But if we say an EGFR mutation exists in about 10% of American population, if we look at all people with lung cancer, we're looking at almost 20,000 individuals in whom we can really make an impact by delivering the right therapy initially. That certainly improves quality of life. It changes our healthcare delivery, though, because we're not wasting time with drugs that are also expensive and may not be the most efficient for these patients. The ALK story is a very exciting one. It does occur in a small fraction of patients with lung cancer, in 3 to 4%. But that number is far greater than all patients with common diseases such as CML, for which there is a cottage industry in providing drugs. We really need to understand that this is a huge toll, and doing the work such as genotyping will have an enormous effect on our healthcare.
And to give an idea of the magnitude of the benefit for selecting the right targeted therapy by the right target, we can talk with patients about a response rate in the range of 70%. For EGFR inhibitors like erlotinib or gefitinib in other parts of the world, both inhibitors of a portion, the tyrosine kinase portion of the EGFR protein. And with crizotinib, another 60-65% response rate. And importantly, these are very prolonged responses in many patients that can exceed a year, sometimes several years. Certainly, identifying the right drugs for the right patients is inestimably great.
We look at EGFR mutations and ALK translocations. We also often will ask for RAS mutations. So RAS mutations occur in about 30% of adenocarcinomas, and they confer resistance to EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. So that might help you prescribe a different chemotherapy in the second line setting or the third line setting for a patient who has a RAS mutation. You may not want to give erlotinib. You may choose to give docetaxel or pemetrexed instead.
And I think there's, you know, continuing controversy. It brings up the issue we've said time and time again. In order to do these sorts of tests, you have to have an adequate amount of tissue. So it gets back to the initial tissue acquisition point of view. And then the next question is, you know, in breast cancer, we do what we call reflex testing, which is every breast cancer gets hormone receptors measured in HER2 status. The pathologist automatically do it. Currently, an oncologist has to ask for these sorts of things to be done. And I think there's, at the community level, a great deal of confusion. Who should they test? Should everyone be tested? What clinical factors do you base it on? You can certainly enrich your population if you factor in histology and smoking status and sex and ethnicity. And then the implications of some of these things. I may take a bit of a counter view from Dr. Patel in terms of the implication of a KRAS mutation. I'm not quite sure what to do with that clinically, and certainly in my practice, if I know someone does have a KRAS mutation, although it may alter when I give a drug like erlotinib, it doesn't prevent me from giving that drug, because I think that in that case there may be a difference between objective responses in that population versus the benefit of in survival and progression-free survival.
Well, for our next patient case study, we met with Carolyn, a patient of Dr. Szczesinski's. In cases like Carolyn's, Dr. Szczesinski explains how biomarkers are now being used to target and improve treatment of non-small cell lung cancer.
Being able to raise my children, that's my top goal. I have two little boys, Sam and Ben. They're 10 and 11 years old. Both of the boys have white belts, just beginning. They both enjoy it, and we have a lot of fun. Two years ago, I pulled a muscle on my right inner thigh, and it hurt so bad after a couple of days, I couldn't walk. So I went to a local orthopedist, and he referred me to an oncologist. The next plan was to have a biopsy. They called and told me that it came back positive for adenocarcinoma and that it was lung cancer. After my initial meeting, I thought that I had a year or two to live. When I met Dr. Szczesinski, he was upbeat, and he told me, you know, you've got a couple of spots, but you don't have a lot of cancer in your body. That's a good thing.
Went over your CAT scan, so that actually looked very
At the time that I first met Carolyn, we were involved in a clinical trial that was focusing on patients with adenocarcinoma of the lung who either were never smokers or were patients who had a very light exposure. Carolyn entered that trial and actually was randomized to receive erlotinib in combination with carboplatin and paclitaxel.
After the first two rounds of chemotherapy, I had a CAT scan, and the lesions were reduced down to 0.8 and 0.9 centimeters, which was fantastic.
2 years ago, when I would see a patient like Carolyn, I would be making my clinical decisions about treatment based upon her clinical features, her sex, her histology, her smoking status, her race, whereas today, I think those are important to some extent, but really what you need to know is her biomarkers. Biomarkers are findings in the tumor itself or in the cancer that can be predictive of a benefit or lack of benefit from a particular type of treatment. The use of biomarkers really, I think, has revolutionized the approach to non-small cell lung cancer. As we identify what drives these diseases, we will be able to target our therapies much more effectively. Carolyn's prognosis has really not changed. She has a treatable cancer, but she does not have a curable cancer. Carolyn's doing quite well right now, symptomatically.
My outlook on life right now is very good. I try to surround myself with people who can make me laugh.
Load up. Potatoes and chicken.
I have very busy days with the children, making sure that their lives are good. You guys are doing awesome. And I try to keep a positive outlook because I do want to be around here for them. I want to see my own grandchildren.
Carolyn fell into a special group of patients with very little exposure to tobacco. She was on a clinical trial. She got chemotherapy combined with a targeted agent, and as you can see, she's actually doing very well at this point. She's a very nice example of the type of patient that if I met her today, we would be interested in interrogating her tumor for EGFR mutations, and if they weren't there, we would interrogate it for an ALK translocation and look for things that could be potentially treatable. And I think she's a nice example of how patients with appropriate therapies can do relatively well from a quality of life point of view.
So what does the latest research say about biomarkers?
The patients who receive EGFR inhibitors and have an EGFR mutation can have a response rate in the range of 70%, and these responses can last for a year or several years. One important thing that we've also seen is that it may really matter what the order of treatment is important. You could imagine that as long as everyone gets the same treatments over time, everyone's going to end up doing the same. In fact, there was a study that was just presented at this annual ASCO meeting that randomized patients to receive chemotherapy followed by erlotinib or erlotinib followed by chemotherapy. And so everyone should have received the same combination of drugs over time. In fact, in this population, which was not segregated by having an EGFR mutation or not, the patients who started with chemotherapy did better than the patients who started with erlotinib. Now, I don't think that the results would necessarily be the same for patients with an EGFR mutation, but it does suggest that there are consequences to guessing wrong about whether someone has an EGFR mutation or not, that if you don't do testing and just say, well, this is a never smoker with an adenocarcinoma, we're going to give erlotinib and plan to give chemo and it'll all come out in the wash, that may not be the right strategy. And it really highlights that the biology and the biomarkers trump the clinical variables.
The real world issue we face, though, is that some of this molecular typing doesn't happen overnight. Many institutions don't do it in-house. We often have specialized laboratories that we need to send our studies to. And it can be a 2 or 3 week turnaround period for many of us in 2010. Hopefully the story is very different a year or 2 years from now. But often we're faced with a patient with whom we have a very high suspicion they have an EGFR mutation, but again, we're wrong about 50% of the time despite clinical phenotype. And a patient who may be very symptomatic from their disease. Those patients should get chemotherapy initially. And you can, if you don't know, those patients should certainly get chemotherapy. And then you can work out the issues with genotype afterwards.
You know, I think we'll look back at the importance of the IPASS trial. It was a landmark trial. It was a very important trial because it established the value of biomarkers in genotyping patients, that was much more predictive than what we were doing prior to that, which was relying on the phenotype, the clinical features of the patient. And I think that that was really the foot in the door. It told us that all non-small cell lung cancer is not non-small cell lung cancer. It created a subset of patients in which the direction of therapy should be, I would argue, 180 degrees different than we've been doing it for over 10 years, which is the platinum-based doublet plus or minus a targeted therapy approach. This was a very different approach, and it was targeted at a biologic phenomenon that made that cancer very susceptible to a specific treatment, an EGFR kinase inhibitor.
Despite data on the role of emerging and targeted therapies, we know that there are still significant barriers when it comes to treating non-small cell lung cancer. What are some of these barriers?
Lung cancer has suffered from stigmatism or from a stigma, social stigma, for a long time. It's a smoking-associated disease, and many patients have chronic other comorbidities. So physicians themselves are often reluctant to refer patients whom they seem as frail or a disease that they may pass judgment on upon as self-inflicted. They may have some nihilism and not refer as quickly for chemotherapy. Also, patients. This is an elderly group of patients, and often they're not able to advocate for themselves. It's a story that's very different from breast cancer, which has a dynamic group of young people advocating for breast cancer research. But patients often, because of family support, because of their age, are unable to make a trip to the oncologist or make a trip to an oncologist who's excited about treating lung cancer to find what therapeutic options there are.
Would you talk a little bit more about the differences in outcomes among minority patients in particular?
There are documented differences in terms of outcomes, survival outcomes based upon race. And, you know, there might be very many reasons for that. It has a lot to do with access to care. It has a lot to do with socioeconomic status. It may have a lot to do with geography. It may have a lot to do with the beliefs and how information is presented to patients about the therapeutic benefit of treatment. You know, I do think we also, on the other end of the spectrum, have evidence that if you look at minority populations that are enrolled in clinical trials, and so what a clinical trial does is try to homogenize the population as best as one can do based upon clinical features. And it also gives the same therapy and the same management strategies to these patients. If you look at modern-day large phase 3 clinical trials, the outcomes, for instance, we've published some data looking at outcomes between Caucasians and African-Americans, and their outcomes are the same. But this is a select group of the population. It's not the population as a whole. Obviously, to get on a clinical trial, you have to be at a site where the clinical trial is being done. You have to be go through the informed consent process. You have to be a candidate for that. You have to agree to do that and have access to that. So those are many barriers that are overcome getting to a clinical trial that may not be necessarily the same barriers that one has on so-called Main Street USA, if you will.
In that sense, the results with minority populations mirror what we see in an elderly population, which is not really a minority in the lung cancer community, but is woefully understudied. And fortunately, that is getting better. We have more studies specifically focusing on older patients, and we've really desperately needed that, because what we see again and again is that older patients, 70s and now increasingly 80s and beyond, are not even referred to oncologists, not getting treated. And yet we do have therapies now that are far less toxic and potentially far more beneficial than what preconceived notions may be about the treatments for lung cancer.